You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is Ship in a Bottle. I'm Colin from Warwickshire in England.
And I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. Colin!
Hi.
How are you, mate?
I'm alright, it's been a while.
Yes, it has. I'm trying to figure out how long it's been. Was it Time Zero, Part 2?
Yeah.
You and Kenan McDuff! Why do I do that all the time?
Hang on, one second. That's the first episode of the season. That's like 11 weeks ago.
No, it hasn't been 11 weeks ago. It's been probably more like 3-4 months ago.
Yeah, because we've been a bit of a gap. So.
I suck, guys. I don't know why I do a podcast. All right. Well, hey, Colin, thanks for coming on again.
It's a pleasure.
Absolutely. And whenever you wish, the synopsis for tonight's show is...
Hang on, let me scroll up.
Yeah, I know. Gotta expand that box.
Right. The original release date is January the 25th, 1993. Oh. This is episode 12 of season 6 of Star Trek The Next Generation. It was written by René... I can never get that bloody name right. It's written by René. Yeah. Directed by Alexander Singer. Guest stars include Daniel Davis as James Moriarty. He was brilliant as always. Stephanie Beecham as Regina Bartholomew. Dwight Schwartz as the impeccable Reginald Barclay. Clement von Frankenstein as gentleman, or should we say murder suspect, and Majel Barrett as the voice of computer. So, me, personally, I like this episode. I think it's well written. I think it's the pacing is great. There's wit, there's charm. I just like this episode. What do you two think?
You forgot Sargassity. That was another
one. Oh, God, yeah. I had to Google that.
Yeah, I did too. And he forgot to mention that the synopsis for tonight's show is Professor Moriarty returns. Only this time he gains control of the Enterprise in his quest to leave the holodeck. This is a good, it is a nice episode. I like this one. We get Reginald Barclay, which I think, like I said before, gives it an extra point. And of course, it enhances the notion that security and IT on the Enterprise is a very, very sucky thing. But then again, it wasn't real, so...
Spoiler.
Yeah. Nobody has seen this 30-year-old show. No. James, what about you?
Okay. So I think this episode is rather unobjectionable. However, I object to the following. I don't like the way they try to explain holodeck technology in this. This is one of the very few. So the less you know about holodecks, the better, because they don't make sense. And in this episode, they try to make sense of them, and I don't think it works. So as long as you're willing to put up with the fact that all of this kind of chatter about holodecks and people being real and stuff could really have been ended almost immediately, and it shouldn't be touched with a 50-foot pole, then, you know, it's a rather pleasant caper. I'll put it like that.
I wonder how many holodeck episodes there is where the holodeck doesn't break in some way.
I don't recall any.
I was actually thinking, I think that what they should do, they should design ships. By all means, keep the holodecks on the ship. But what they should do, they should make it a bit like, you know, the captain's yacht, where it can be easily jettisoned.
So that just in case. Like the warp
just core. In case anything goes wrong, you can, like, jettison the holodeck. And it's like, you know, you could... So make it fail-safe so you can even jettison it, like, manually and push it out. Because these things are death traps, right?
Mm. Yeah, they cause an awful lot of problems for something that's supposed to be a recreation.
Yeah. Maybe they just need to change the file attributes to read-only. I mean, that would solve some of the problem. Or how about no such thing as safeties that malfunction?
Well, that's another thing with the holodeck. You can override the safety protocols so you can die in the holodeck. Why is that even a thing?
It shouldn't be. I can't imagine a ray of light killing somebody.
No, I mean, imagine going to Laser Quest and you've got the option to have real bullets instead of lasers.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so as we said, the story starts on the holodeck. And I put on there, nothing could possibly go wrong. Holmes and Watson is investigating a murder, or as Geordi put it, murder most foul. I think he used those words once.
He did. I think LeVar Burton, I think, was particularly enjoying his chance to seriously overact.
Absolutely. So it would appear that a man's been poisoned. Strychnine, to be exact. In fact, a vial of poison was found in his dead hands. Oh, but there's no way that could possibly be, because he would have destroyed the vial. And let's not forget the suicide note written in his own dear brother's hand. So, was my accent good?
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Is it as good as Moriarty's is? Didn't you make comments in the past, James, about how he has a terrible British accent?
No. He's good. I think he's good. Is he not British?
I don't know.
And I don't know what the Countess is. So here's the problem. I think both him and the Countess are pretty convincing. So, you know, on occasion, I've told you who I think the worst English accent is in Star Trek. And he only turned out to be a Brit. So I'm, like, staying away from this stuff.
You mean the Frenchman?
The Countess. The Frenchman, yeah.
The Frenchman?
The Frenchman's definitely British.
Sorry, what?
Stephanie Beecham.
Oh, yeah, the Countess. Yeah.
Oh, no. In my opinion, the worst English accent I've ever heard on Star Trek is Malcolm Reed.
Oh! Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah, he was a Brit.
I had no idea that he was a Brit, or even... Actually, the worst thing is, yes, he sounds like that in reality as well. So, yeah, that was odd.
Maybe he's lost some of it over the years. Okay, let's talk about this whole right-hand, left-hand thing.
By the way, Daniel Davies is an American.
Aha! Well then, he pulls it off pretty good. But the left-hand, right-hand thing, he catches a box of matches with his right hand. Alright, so? I mean, don't you catch a ball with your opposite hand that you would throw it on? Throw it with?
No.
So when we play baseball here, if you're a right-handed thrower, you're a left-handed catcher.
Really?
How would you throw a ball with a glove in your hand?
Well, you only have one good dude throwing the ball, and you have many people catching, right?
Well, yes, but no, hold on. So when the ball is, you know, that little stick that hits the ball, it flies all the way out to a catcher. Now, he's got to catch it and then throw it to the baseman. Now, I don't know about there. I don't know how it could possibly be different. But here, if I'm a right-handed thrower, the glove has to be in my left hand.
There's no left-handed pitchers?
Of course. Then the glove would be in my right hand.
Well, things that because you're using gloves, right, you guys are effectively forcing one hand to be catch only.
Yes.
So at that point, you're just going to, you know, you're going to have to take the trade-off between, you know, the hand with the big glove is going to be the catching hand. The one without it is going to be the throwing hand. And that's it. You know, you have to compromise. Whereas, I mean, most games that involve throwing balls, you don't have like a big, giant a glove on it.
Yeah. And I didn't have gloves on, so I would naturally catch it with a dominant hand.
That makes sense. I guess, you know, throw a rock up in the air, I'm going to catch it with the hand I threw it up with.
Yeah, because it's your dominant hand.
Hmm. Okay. All right. But I digress, and I promised Colin I wouldn't do that, so. The holodeck.
You're the one who's operating on zero sleep, so you go.
I was going to say, yeah, you don't have to get to bed right now, do you?
No. Oh, no, okay. It's 2:30 in the afternoon here.
Yeah, turnabout's fair play, huh? Okay, so the holodeck seems to be malfunctioning, believe it or not. But at least this time nobody's in danger, right? Sort of. Okay. I've brought this up before, and I'm going to bring it up again. Freeze program. Why, when they say freeze program, the damn flame still flickers in the... Does that make any sense?
You're not supposed to notice that.
Yeah?
Yeah.
No, we've had this discussion before. Look, it's just that you have a computer game, you press pause on the computer game, some of the animations still carry on. It will be dependent on the computer game. It's fine.
I guess it has to be. I mean, I get it. It's a nitpick. It's just one of those that bothers me. I mean, you can even see the guy when you freeze program. He... Stay still.
One second here. I'm gonna. Unfortunately, I've like gone off on a tangent, and I have. So the lady that plays the Countess,
Stephanie Beecham.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Apparently, it was in Coronation Street, which is a soap in the UK.
Can I take your word for it? Don't watch soaps.
Okay.
Yeah.
Apparently, she was in Dynasty.
Oh, Dynasty. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's why she looks so familiar to me.
Is that a soap?
Yes. Okay, I don't know if I really watched it.
And this is one that's really gonna, you know, gonna hit you in the hit you, Colin. About 10 years ago, she was in a series of Celebrity Big Brother here in the UK.
I don't watch that either.
No, of course not. I mean, no, she's British.
Yeah, I said she was British.
Yeah, but wow. I mean, she ended up fifth place in Celebrity Big Brother 2010.
Hmm. I would not have known that.
Well, no. I mean, neither would I. And I try my best.
She's done movies and all, though, hasn't she?
Well, I assume that she hasn't managed to survive entirely on one episode of TNG.
I don't know. I mean, no, I know, but I mean, soap stars get, well, depends on what soap you're in, but soap stars, especially in America, they seem to do all right.
Yeah, yeah. Dynasty was pretty big, too.
Yeah.
So, obviously, he caught the matches in his with the wrong hand. Curious, there must be a problem with the holodeck. Let's call Barclay.
Okay, so the problem that I have with this, by the way, is that let's just assume for a second that he did catch it with the hand that Data suggests that he should catch with. Is that enough evidence to convict the dude? You know, does all of the evidence fall to pieces simply because of that in one instance he used a non-dominant hand to catch something?
I would assume that once he caught it in the left hand, he would have gone into another, like, diatribe about the evidence and stuff like that, but because it was in the wrong hand, I just cut to Geordi saying, Data, it's in the wrong hand.
Yeah, I would hope that his entire prosecution doesn't hinge on this
Yeah, whether you're left or right handed. Yeah.
Mm. What if he dropped the matches? Then what?
Yeah. Although there has been court cases where people have used handwriting as evidence.
I like the television court case where the defense attorney says, I found who the real killer is, and they're coming through this door right now. And everybody turns around and waits, except for the defendant. Because there is no real killer. That person really did it. So that's probably a Perry Mason thing. Tell me you guys know who Perry Mason is.
No idea. What is he? Is he an actor of some description?
Yeah, he played a defense attorney back in the 50s, I think. Okay, so Barclay's running to the holodeck. He's got to fix that broker really fast. Whoa, Ridge, slow down. I wonder how many women and children he ran down to get there so fast.
So, I've got a problem with this, but I'm going to nitpick this, which is basically that the holodeck is just, you know, Geordi's equivalent of his PlayStation. And he's using a trained professional.
I'd say more his
it's more of an Xbox because it keeps breaking down.
Yeah.
So he's using a trained professional, you know, like, you know, a decade worth of experience in Barclay to, hey, my computer's broken, or, you know, my latest Gears of War game seems to be corrupted. Please fix it. I mean, what is he doing? Why is Starfleet paying for Barclay to be on hand to fix computer games? It doesn't seem right.
He's a low man.
It was unreasonably nice the way that Geordi spoke to him. Because as a rule, when Geordi speaks to people, he's quite condescending.
Mm-hmm.
So he was positively polite to Barclay.
And did you, of course, notice that they introduced this thing here now for the sole purpose of being able to reveal non-Geordi later?
Yes.
Which is, I was going to say clever, but I don't think clever is the word.
It was an interesting scene where, like, fake Geordi was trying to process the fact that fake Geordi was fake.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then Picard, like, politely asked him to leave.
Well, Geordi
please
was...
go away. Yeah, and this fake Geordi is obviously going to walk back to his quarters and sit there in some type of existential angst for the next 20 hours before being deleted from history.
Yeah.
Well, he was completely in the conversation until they determined he wasn't real. Then all of a sudden, he just turned into a wall mat or whatever. Just kind of looking like,
This episode raises things about artificial life forms. Because if you think back to Data with the exocomps, Data was quite prepared to sacrifice human crew members to save the exocomps. Yet when he's dealing with photonic artificial life forms, he treats them completely differently.
Well, the argument would be that these guys aren't sentient or indeed alive, right? That's just a representation or just a program being run.
Data's just a program.
Well, no, but I think Data, there is an acceptance that Data has, there has to be an inherent kind of consciousness that has evolved from his neural net, because otherwise otherwise, frankly, you could just duplicate him. And, you know, if he is just code, right, then just copy the code across.
Yeah, but then you get into things like the Doctor in Voyager, or Vic Fontaine in DS9, who are photonic life forms that get treated as humans, so to speak.
Yeah, I think in the case of Vic Fontaine, though, it's much more to do with the psychological makeup of, Sisko and Bashir and the others trying to find a friend that's not going to be killed during the war than really being a thing of it. And what the hell happened in the Mirror Universe with him being an android? That made no sense.
Yeah, save that for when you do DS9. But they do. I mean, especially in Voyager, with the whole Doctor starts off as a program and he has to fight to be accepted. But they've got like several years to flesh that out, whereas this has got 40 minutes.
No, I agree, and I do think the issue with the Doctor in Voyager is that there is an acceptance, or at least I read it as there's an acceptance that he's a program being executed until he reaches a certain level, and then he has kind of an emergent kind of consciousness or you maybe want to use the word soul in this case, as he matures. And there is a point, you know, you can't necessarily just assume that anything that you program is alive. But at the same time, once you've lived with the Doctor for X number of years and he seems to be as real as anyone else, then treating him as if it's just a light switch again doesn't quite make sense either. But wait, didn't they reset the Doctor and Voyager around season 4 anyway?
They erased some memories because he was having PTSD.
Yeah.
A big control or delete, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
And reboot in safe mode.
Yeah, and besides, isn't Data really pretty much a light switch too? I mean, and now a man will turn it off, click.
Yeah. Well, he's a machine that's programmed to imitate human life.
Yeah.
Then he's got a learning matrix. It's like, I don't know, the Terminator. They have a learning CPU, so they can blend in.
Yeah. He just looks human. I don't know. I think.
But this is what this episode does. It brings up the morality and the philosophical argument about what is life.
Yeah. In a sense, Maddox does make sense, you know. He just looks like a person, so therefore you're supposed to just give him personhood. Okay, so I spotted a flaw in the holodeck, and I never noticed this before.
Just the one?
Just one. But when Data and Geordi walk out and Reg walks in, look at the ground. Look at the hollow grid. You know, the yellow lines.
See the carpet?
You see the carpet. I've never realized it was a carpet.
Yeah, it's a black carpet with yellow tape on.
Yeah, because you can see where the carpet goes, you know, meets up with the wall.
Yeah.
That's something I never have noticed until yesterday.
What would you expect it to be?
I thought it was like a black floor, hard
like
tile floor,
like a mat or something.
With the yellow lines running across a grid. Because when they walk on the thing, you hear like their hard shoes walking on like solid wood or something. You don't hear them walking on carpet. Maybe it's just a
carpet.
It's carpet because you can see lumps in it. It's amazing. Yeah, guys, pull out your Blu-ray and check it out. Unless they fixed it then.
No, there's actually images you can get on the internet of where the carpet's moved, where people have been walking on it in certain scenes.
That I did not know. Okay, so run a diagnostic on all Sherlock Holmes files and identify any anomalies. The results, all the files are squeaky clean. It will, except for those in protected memory. So I would imagine, you know, that could mean special files that only the author wants to run.
Yes.
Protected memory.
Run protected memories. Oh, okay. Turn that off quick.
Yeah, I don't want to see that. But, so what does Barclay do? He runs it. So, you know, it could be a recreation of, Data and Holmes, or Data as Holmes, go into a brothel. Maybe he might not want to see that. Or
you would imagine someone with Barclay's kind of experience in relatively, how should we say, niche holodeck experiences, mm-hmm. he would be a little bit more careful of running just whatever he finds in protected memory. I mean, he's probably sitting there going, oh, protective memory, that old trick. That's where we kept them.
That's what I used to do when I used to have a hollow addiction. But anyway, luckily it wasn't. But what does pop up? Professor Moriarty, Holmes's arch enemy. I do like the interaction between Barclay and Moriarty, don't you?
Well, they used the interaction between them to explain to people who haven't seen the previous episode what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's clever.
Yeah.
Yep, it's Holographic Environment Simulator Subroutine 20389, program titled Dr. James Moriarty. So, doctor or professor? I guess both. Which is more pristine, James? Doctor or professor?
Well, I don't know how it is, how it was back then, but nowadays you are given a doctorate, which is a professional qualification. So that's something that you can earn by going to school and studying. A professorhood is a, within the English system at least, is still, it's a post that the university offers you. So you are a professor, of, effectively you should consider that as a job title rather than a qualification.
Oh, okay.
So almost all professors will be, I mean, when I say almost all, 99.999% of professors will have the title of doctor, but they also would have spent 20 years or so in the field studying, at least in the sciences. Now, maybe on the non-science side, you might have various universities that appoint people as professors that don't have a formal educational background, and I can imagine that, I mean, there might be certain circumstances when that happens, but within, you know, within the UK science world, at least, just consider a doctorate as being what someone studies for, and then a professorship is something that they get 30 years later from a university as a, almost like a, as a fellow or as a position.
Okay. All right. Well, Barclay unlocks the sequence and runs the program, and guess what pops out? No, not a Jack in the Box. It's Professor Moriarty, and he's pissed that he's been in limbo for the last 4 years. He's self-aware and is alive, or at least he claims to be, aware of the passage of time. I can't imagine how that's even possible. But he wants to meet the captain at the sitting room on Baker Street. What's a sitting room?
A lounge.
Oh. I suppose it's just a place where chairs are? I guess.
It is a room where you sit.
Yeah.
It's like a sitting room.
I mean, in Victorian England, you had the reception room, the sitting room, the dining room. You had rooms basically designated for specific tasks.
Hmm. Okay. And then, of course, you had the sexing room. Oh, no, just a bedroom. All right.
That's where all the bedding went on.
That's the bedding room. So, Reg ends the program and walks out of the holodeck. Or at least, he thinks he did. And he goes to report to LaForge. Which, you know, good use of the chain of command. He didn't just run to the bridge.
Reg does actually walk off the proper holodeck at that point.
Mm-hmm. And this is where it gets weird. I'm having trouble figuring out how did he get a program within a program running? Because when Picard, Data, and Barclay walk into the holodeck, they're not walking into a program within a program. They're walking into program one. When did program two get started and how?
When they walk into the holodeck to meet Moriarty, that's program one, right?
So what are we defining as program one?
When Picard meets Moriarty for the first time.
Yeah.
So when Barclay brings him down, that's them walking into the holodeck, right?
Yes.
When the holodeck door closes, that's when program two starts. So when they think, from that point onwards, they're in Moriarty's program.
But he had to wait
for the door to close to separate the realities.
So program one was a holographic image of the holodeck.
Yes.
So they walked into the running program.
They literally walked into the trap.
And then when they started,
when the door closes, the trap is sprung.
I get it. Okay, I couldn't understand how they got into another one, and later we're gonna figure. That's another question: Is it still two programs or is it now three?
If you think of the film First Contact, right? Mm-hmm. Picard opens up a chapter in the book, right? Mm-hmm. When he's in the holodeck, he realizes he's in the wrong chapter and he goes to the next chapter and the holodeck changes around him.
Right.
That's basically what Moriarty does in this. As soon as that door closes, he runs the next program, but they don't notice because it changes around them.
Yeah, they think it's just an ordinary program running.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. All right, so... So the ship, actually, we forgot about the mission. What was the actual mission?
Oh, this is the one where I was waiting for James for, because I was watching this and I was thinking... Gonna get James to explain to me how two colliding planets makes a star.
Exactly. Especially when they have no matter. They were just gaseous planets. So
hang on. Whoa. Hang on. What do you mean they have no matter? I mean, they might not have a solid iron core, but they have matter, right? Matter is anything.
I thought they said there was no matter. It was just a gaseous.
I think they said no solid surface.
Oh, maybe. But explain how two planets colliding, even if they were solid planets, could create a new star.
Well, actually, the thing is that the solid planet is a force friend here, because having two solid planets collide would not make a star. Gaseous planets are probably much better. The reason being, right, is that when you're talking about solid planets, what you really are talking about is heavy elements, so things like iron and stuff like that. If you want a star to be formed, effectively you're talking about hydrogen being brought together and fusing. So the reaction that a star needs to do is basically hydrogen fusion, which is not, there's not going to be any hydrogen in the rocky planets anyway. But basically what they're saying here is that you've got a very, very big thing that is a gaseous planet. You've got another very, very big thing that is another gaseous planet. They are both underneath the threshold during which they would start, you know, kind of nuclear fusion and keeping themselves going in the way that the our sun does. But when they get combined together and the force of the energy and stuff, it effectively just kicks off a fusion reaction. And that's perfectly legitimate. I mean, it's unlikely that the circumstances that would be needed are quite... It's unlikely to be one planet just hitting into another one and then makes the star. But in terms of what you should be looking for to form a star is, you know, a large amount of compression of helium. Have I been saying helium? Because I should have been saying hydrogen. I hope I haven't been saying helium. But a large amount of compression of hydrogen bodies into a smaller space, which is what you would kind of get through these two gas giants hitting each other. So I don't think it's completely crazy.
Ah.
It would be a small star.
So if something like, say, something like Saturn and Jupiter colliding.
No, that's too small.
I was going to say, albeit on a bigger scale, they could conceivably create a small star.
Yes. Yeah.
And how can the Enterprise just be sitting down the block from that and not get destroyed?
But why would they be destroyed? What is the threat here? What are you concerned about?
Well, that massive ring of energy that, you know, shot outward from this new star essentially enveloped the Enterprise. But yet they survived it. How does that happen? It's a shockwave. Why didn't it affect them?
That the shields up.
Shields up, so the idea of it creating the star isn't really... Look, what you have, you've got something that's very, very large and almost the size of a star, and you've got another thing that's very, very large and almost the size of a star, and that's just not, you know, there's not enough heat in the body to keep nuclear fusion going, and when you smash them together, you happen to start creating nuclear fusion. Now, the entirety of the mass that was there before in these two planets still remains the same mass that the combined planet/star thing has. So it's no more of a threat than the two planets before you smash them together. Now, yeah, you might have an eruption here or an eruption there, but it's not as if once you have taken a disk of hydrogen or a ball of hydrogen and started off a nuclear fusion reaction. Somehow this thing propagates forever and blows up the entire universe. It's a relatively controlled thing, obviously within the confines of, you know, we're talking about here, astronomical kind of like space. So this is, so all the Enterprise has to do is just get out of the way slightly. So it should be pretty much business as usual, I would imagine, for the Enterprise.
Hang on, it didn't affect them because they're still on the holodeck.
Well,
I mean, the rest of the ship was not in the holodeck.
No, I'm joking.
No, they got out of
here. Oh, don't know, though, because if you think about it, the end, spoiler, Barclay says computer, end program, right? Now, technically, the computer should have responded because he's on the ship. But the fact the computer didn't respond, that should have been more of concern for him that the computer didn't respond.
No, I don't know. Why would it respond if?
Because it would normally, because it responds to a request. So a computer run program, the computer should have said something like, "There are no programs running," or please clarify your statements," or something like that.
That's true. Yeah, it would have.
He didn't say anything.
Nothing. All right. Okay, so let's see. They return to the holodeck, and Reg asks the computer to place them in the drawing room at 221B Bicker Street. Not the sitting room, the drawing room.
Yeah.
Nitpick. Okay, so I took the liberty of looking up that address, and it appears it's a fictional address. However,
there's an interesting story behind this, and I don't know if I mentioned this before, but carry on.
Well, you could probably explain this more, but I did find out that there is a Holmes Museum,
yep,
and it's actually located between 237 and 241 Baker Street. So
yep,
since you've been there a dozen times at least, tell us about it.
Okay, so first of all, Baker Street is a street in London, so it's a well-known place. It's actually got a tube, tube stop as well. Mm. Now, 221B Baker Street, I don't think ever existed as a 221B. But 221, going back, it has to be about 20 years ago, I think, is when they moved out. but it was the headquarters of one of the British banks that we had, or I think at the time it would have been a building society. So the Abbey National were at 221 Baker Street. And I am told that they ended up getting a fair amount of post sent to them from abroad. Mm. People believe in it to be, you know, Sherlock Holmes's address. Now, on top of that, down the road, a couple of stops from where 221B is expected to exist, there was another place, and I think they took on the address of 221B Baker Street, which is the Holmes Museum now. I don't know if they're technically 221B or whether they're still under a, as you mentioned, that between those two numbers. But yeah, they have got a Holmes Museum on 221 on Baker Street, where just about whereabouts you would expect it to be. And I have been there. I took the wife there maybe 20 years ago, something like that, when we were at university. My university was just down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And this is before Holmes got kind of, I think Holmes has had a bit of a resurgence in the last 15 years. So this was like a long time ago, a lot, certainly pre the latest incarnations that there have been on the BBC and others.
Benedict Cumberbatch,
Mr. Khan, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, we don't mention that film.
No, he wouldn't be Mr. Khan. Mr. Singh, Mr. Khan Noonien
Singh. Mr. Singh, Khan Noonien Singh.
All right. So Picard tries to talk to Moriarty, but of course he doesn't believe anything he says. He's just a lying Brit. No, nope. He's just a lying Frenchman. Sorry. I can never remember what he is. Is it all just an act? Well, who knows? But the man is brilliant in any century. Wait, who said that? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, that made me smile when Geordi says the man is brilliant in every century, when you know that Geordi is programmed by Moriarty.
That's true. Yeah, he would say that.
So a little bit of narcissism there in the program. Mm.
So how do you guys define Professor, I need you to believe me, if you walk out that door, you will cease to exist? Does that mean like in dead? Or can't they just simply recall him back to the program?
Well, if you think of the Dixon Hill episode, they basically faded into nothing. Although extremely slowly, which always puzzled me, because you'd think once they moved past the holoprojectors, that'd be it, but hey.
And also from the bottom up, wasn't it?
Yeah, from the bottom
up. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, Cyrus Redblock. He dissolved really, really slowly.
Yeah, from the bottom up.
Whereas in
reality, once you move past the holometer, that should be it.
That's another question. Why can't the hollow... Actually, if he walked out of the door, I would imagine the hollow emitter still could project into the hallway. But once he gets past the doors, that's when there's nothing
to keep him there. The way the holodeck works is it creates a 3D image. So if you've only got a certain amount of emitters that can reach through the doorway, the image wouldn't be 3D.
I see. But either way, he thinks, therefore he is. And I can never say that word. James, help me.
Sorry, what are we looking for?
Cogito ergo sum.
Oh, no, I never did Latin.
Ah, me either. But he walks out the door and says, Contrical ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Wow! He didn't disappear.
Which straight away, like, you know, they established an encounter at Farpoint that Data can see through the imperfections in the holodeck. So from that point onwards, why wasn't Data picking up on the fact that they were still in the holodeck?
They've had an upgrade. Well, no, they must have. They must have evolution or so. I can only imagine. But I think this is the point, right, where where they haven't actually stepped out of the holodeck. They've continued the program in the.
That's what I mean. They're in Moriarty's program now.
So. I think all of this would have been better maybe had they had Data kind of indisposed somewhere.
Yeah, the flaw in the whole of this is the person who solves it, which is Data.
Because, look, so he didn't take Troy into the holodeck, because again, had you taken Troy into the holodeck, you would have realized, or Troy would have been able to realize very quickly that this person's not a human, this person's a holodeck character. So,
yeah, because you won't be able to sense them.
And in a way, also Geordi, right? Geordi must be able to see different things for the holodeck versus...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you couldn't have genuine Geordi in there because his visor would see through it.
Yeah, but you've got holodeck Deanna, who's going to see holodeck characters, and of course she's going to say they're real.
Yeah, but the reason... The thing is, you can't, like James says, you can't take Troy in because she would sense that they're not real because she's not getting anything off him. You can't take Geordi in because his visor would see through the fact that it's a program.
Yeah,
and it's not real. But by the same token, they establish in Encounter of Farpoint that Data can see the walls of the holodeck.
Tell me about that. I don't remember.
When he meets Riker for the first time in Encounter of Farpoint, Data throws a rock at the holodeck wall.
Oh, that's right.
And he tells Riker he can see the imperfections. He says to Riker he can see the imperfections in the holodeck because his eyesight's that much better than the humans.
Oh, I thought he just knew where the walls were. And...
No, he actually says, I can see the imperfections in the holodeck.
I didn't remember that one.
Okay. Like I'm just about the number.
Okay, so...
But then that plays into later on when he throws his comm badge at the warp core. Because he knows it's the wall.
Right. So he figures it out eventually, but he is not getting it at the beginning.
Yeah.
Okay. So the policeman that he knows in any century, it looked to me they were just like waiting around the corner because he just like stepped right around the corner. They weren't striding as they were walking. They were just there.
And but this is the wonderful thing with Starfleet security. Sometimes when you call them, they take a long time to come. Oh. And then other times when you call them, they're around the corner.
They're precogs. Yeah. Okay. So I got a kick out of this part here. What sea does she sail? And can we go above deck? Weather permitting. What is its means of locomotion? It's just, it's interesting that he's a 19th century character who just realizes that he's actually in space. And he's the only one that doesn't freak out about it.
But he knew he was in space before, because they told him that.
Ah, no.
But the fact that he wrote the program himself, he must know that they're in space.
Yeah.
Oh, that makes sense. And he's just, yeah, that's true.
He's just playing the part. He's playing the part to keep the card happy.
Yeah.
But this scene, and also this scene, Picard seems more concerned that he behaves himself. He seems more concerned the fact that Moriarty doesn't break any crimes than the fact that there's a hologram standing in front of him.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, he feels the need to point out that criminal behavior is just as unacceptable and it's a lot harder to get away with. But, you know, of course, people are still going to try.
Well, yeah. Otherwise, they wouldn't have penal colonies.
Yeah, and you know something? He does play it pretty good because he goes from not believing a word Picard says to, I believe you, I believe you. You know, but do you think you could maybe get my girlfriend out of that holodeck too?
Yes, I can think of a certain number of people at work who would quite happily leave their partner in the holodeck.
Take the safeties off. Oops. Sorry. Oops. Sorry about that. Okay. But Picard says, you know, he can't see sanctioning doing it again. Why not? I mean, why is he so concerned? If the Countess dissolves, she dissolves. She's just a holodeck program, but he seems to be genuinely concerned that, you know, we wouldn't know how to do it again. And there is another interesting dilemma. What if they could do it again? How many people could be created and just walk off the holodeck? I think Riker'd be down there in an instant trying to reprogram Minuet to get her off the holodeck.
This is Picard being a diplomat.
Yeah, right.
Which is what Picard is. He's a diplomat. And this is him being a diplomat. He's trying to keep Moriarty on side. By not making false promises. And that's him being a diplomat.
Yeah. I mean, but still, you know, you'd start a whole new race of holodeck characters that just walk off the holodeck. That'd be amazing that you could do that. So. Okay. So.
Yeah, and then you end up with the Voyager episode where photonic life forms go around killing solids.
Yeah, that was stupid.
So, Luke, can you hear me?
I can now.
Good, sorry. I think I was on mute before. I actually think that this bit's quite clever because I don't think people see through this at this stage. So Moriarty is, what he's really trying to do here, he's trying to get them to think of a way of being able to get himself off the holodeck because he's not yet off the holodeck. And the fact that he's managed to wrap it as a concern for the Countess, I think it, from a character perspective, it comes across as legitimate and reasonable. But at the same time, right, it's something that he needs himself. Now, maybe I shouldn't question whether or not he wants the Countess with him, but it is a necessity for him, right? So, you know, whilst he's engaged in this, that we need to get the Countess off the holodeck, we don't have any questions as to why doesn't he just go away, or why doesn't he just, isn't he happy with his lot, etc. And at the same time, the story within the story is that he's got these guys thinking really hard about how to get the Countess off, which becomes, in the real world, you know, how does Riker get him off? And I think it's quite nice how they do that. The other thing I was going to point out is that I also think it's, Picard's a little bit resistant to the idea that let's just try it again for the Countess. And I do think that that's legitimate, both in terms of creating the life and also having her pushed off the holodeck. I do think that if you happen to have created life for accidentally, it's not the same moral implications as doing it. With a will, and that's something that they do at least address. The viewer isn't left thinking, why can't I just make all of these sentient life forms out of the holodeck characters by making sure that they're able to defeat Data each and every time?
Yeah, that's all it would take.
Yeah. I question whether or not that would be all it takes, but apparently that's all it took for Moriarty. But maybe that's more of an issue that I have a problem with the previous episode rather than this one.
So, in theory, the transporter takes you, turns you into energy, and then reconstitutes you into matter. Why couldn't you take energy from the holodeck and turn it into matter? Just because it didn't start as matter?
Well, yeah, so I have a big problem with a lot of this, which is that if you are going to just say energy, by which they probably don't really mean energy per se, but they mean some kind of, some kind of like fundamental particle, description of the individual, and that measured and then that kind of put across, decomposed and then recompiled. If they are going to say that, then I don't think there's really no argument here, as far as I can tell. I think the problem is that if you're going to introduce you introduce the transporter as a way of being able to go from A to B, a person going from A to B. As soon as they then stated that what we do is that we take you and then we boil down to like basically just a pattern and then we send that pattern over there and rebuild you again. As soon as they make that step, the logical thing is, well, why can't you just do that without the original pattern? Why do you have, at what point, what's preventing this becoming a replicator for people or a churning out of soldiers or whatever? And I don't think there's a good answer to that. So I think, unfortunately, while they try to explain what the transporter is, and they basically put it down to like a matter energy converter, there's no reason why you shouldn't be able to just print people.
Yeah. I mean, they just send you over the Wi-Fi. So why couldn't they just start with the signal and just, let's say Picard's beaming up. Why couldn't they just transport 4 of them at the same time?
Well, they do address that in another episode, don't they? Because you have 2 Thomas Rikers.
Yeah, right. Okay, yeah. Well, you only have 1 Thomas Riker, but anyway.
But you also have, a lot of, we've seen different kind of, look, the problem here is that the technology can't exist in the format of which which sometimes it gets described. So the issue about, in Lonely Among Us, they had to create a Picard and they had to like find energy to shove into the transporter room. And they almost expressed it as the energy itself wasn't just energy per se, but it was like the soul of the individual and they had to go and get that energy. In other cases, there's been issues about that we have to find the correct DNA patterns with Pulaski and her hairbrush. But none of these really make sense, and that sometimes they can even be contradictory to the general theory that they put across. And that's one thing I don't like them trying to like reveal a little bit about how it works. I do think that the good thing they did with the transporter is that at very least they put in the Heisenberg compensators, which if you ever get worried about why things work and how they should have worked, just say, well, Heisenberg compensators. So that's good. The thing they start talking about in this episode regarding the holodeck is the they're talking about the matter on the holodeck and not having cohesion outside of the holodeck. And I didn't quite understand what they were talking about there, because that seemed to be... It almost seemed to be like they're talking about that matter in the holodeck is special matter. And
doesn't the holodeck have its own power supply?
Well, things like, initially at least, I always thought the holodeck was just holograms.
Yeah, because it's in Voyager only when they're looking for energy sources and they can't tap into the holodeck because it's a separate, it's a different form of power.
Oh. All right, well, anyway.
Also, a holodeck is basically it's a light beam surrounded by an energy field. So that'd be like saying, "Can you beam the light from a light bulb?" type of thing. Because it's the energy field. It's the light energy surrounded by a force field that makes it solid.
Well, that's fine. I think if you had that description for the holodeck, I think that would work.
Hmm. That makes perfect sense now.
Okay, so if you had it like that, that would work. But you should not entertain in any way, shape, or form something like that walking off the holodeck, going to Dr. Crusher, and people with a straight face saying, "You have DNA." Because that's just... that's ludicrous.
Well, she wouldn't have, but obviously she was programmed to say that.
I mean, maybe they do it like that, right? Because when you start talking about force fields and projections, you almost feel like it's like the object itself. You know, maybe they are just making small diamonds, small minute atoms.
The difference with the transporter and the holodeck is you're transporting DNA in the transporter. Moriarty had no DNA to start with.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that makes sense. It's just a light bulb.
Yeah,
it's a good analogy.
Yeah, I still think I think everything has to be fundamentally, you know, it has to be matter, right? It has to be some type of...
Yeah, but you can't say that something that doesn't have DNA has suddenly got DNA.
No, that's correct.
So for her to say, to all intents and purposes, he's human, but before he was a light being, that didn't add up.
So I certainly think that it should have been a much bigger, like, "You what?" Which is not only that Moriarty kind of comes out, he walks across and stuff like that, but the idea that he used to be a projection or used to be some type of holodeck character, and then all of a sudden he is now made up of exactly the same things as all humans are made up of. I just think that's an unrealistic postulate for the program. So I don't think a holodeck program should be creating these individuals at the DNA level. You know, I'm not even convinced that they create them without their clothes on and then put clothes on the top. So why you'd have to build them up from the molecule upwards is beyond me. You know, do holodeck characters, you know, are you building them up with a stomach? Are you building up with food in their stomach? Are you building them up with a pulse? Or, you know, an entire nervous system. Why would you do that? If the sole purpose is to have these guys exist on the holodeck, you're clearly not building them from DNA upwards. It's overkill.
Okay. Oh, boy. Where was I? All right. Well, anyway, someone has taken control of ship function, of course. Picard's command code's no longer valid. Who could have done that? And on walks Moriarty, strolling onto the bridge to announce that a 19th century fictional character has just taken control of the flagship of the Federation. Through the holodeck, yes.
Which has been done numerous times before.
In real life, yes.
Because Barclay took control of from the holodeck when he turned himself into a supercomputer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been done in another episode. So basically they need some sort of safety system where you can't take control of the bridge from the holodeck.
No, you shouldn't be able to. But again, this isn't the real holodeck, so you got to give them a pass on that one.
Well, no, it's a holodeck inside a holodeck. It's still the holodeck. They're still on the holodeck.
I'm sorry, what I meant was it's not the real ship, so obviously he may not.
No, but he does. He does take control of the ship.
Only because he has Picard's command codes.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is he enters Picard's command codes from the holodeck.
Yeah, he shouldn't be able to.
Yeah. And also, Picard's command codes are voice activated. So can the computer not tell a synthetic voice from a human voice?
That's another thing I wondered. He gave his command code right in front of the Forge. Is he going to change them later so Geordi doesn't go walking around the ship pretending to be him? But then again, it wasn't the real Geordi, so...
It wasn't the real Geordi, no. It was fake Geordi. He was really upset when he found out he was fake.
Yeah. Yeah. You could tell it wasn't just the right amount of brick in his hair. It wasn't the real Geordi.
So, I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
If you go into the holodeck, and on the holodeck you create the Enterprise, and then on that Enterprise you go into the holodeck, and on that holodeck you create the Enterprise again, and then you go into the holodeck to create another one. How many times can you do that before you run out of memory on that Enterprise?
Hmm.
Well, it depends on how big the memory core is.
Yeah, but you'd imagine that the memory for the Enterprise is pretty close to what it needs to be to operate, right? You're not going to have like 50,000 times redundancy kind of thing. You're gonna have maybe an order or two of magnitude, right?
I would imagine.
So all you need to do, you only need to go a couple of those deep before your orders of magnitude start being exhausted. So I reckon there's not enough memory on the Enterprise in order to sustain like 3 deep worth of universes within the holodeck.
Yeah, but you think how big the Enterprise is and how small that cube was at the end.
Well, to be honest with you, I think that's because they wanted to make themselves feel better. I think that cube was going to last like 6.5 weeks, and that's about it.
Until the battery ran out.
I think they jettisoned that cube. We're at very least. I mean, what on earth happened to that cube when the Enterprise crashed?
What, yeah. Generations?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's gone.
Well, I wonder what happened to Livingston when the Enterprise crashed.
Well, yeah. Well, also, the Enterprise had a child. Literally had a child. So what happened to that?
Isn't the child doing well? Why wouldn't that child be doing well?
Well, you don't know. You never hear about it again, do you?
So we're talking about the thing in Emergence, right?
Yeah.
Where it gives
when it literally creates a life form because it's amassed so much data.
Yep. That's how the wife and I did it.
Yeah. And you re-replicated it.
But like the Q did, where you just touch fingers.
Hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was funny, that was.
Jamie. That was. Was Jamie. It good for you? Oh, yeah. God.
Yeah.
Jamie, that's it?
That's it? And he goes, you had your chance. You had your chance.
Yeah. Oh, well. Okay.
It's like the animal kingdom. They do, especially the birds, they do these massively long courtship rituals and it's all over in 5 seconds.
5 seconds. All right. Or how about Harry? You know, it goes down to the Teresia, I believe it was, and you know, he has a wonderful night with 3 different women, but of course they kill him in bed. Could be worth it sometimes, I don't know.
Yeah, well, Harry got space herpes as well, so there you go.
Yeah, there you go. So, okay, so anyway, Moriarty supposedly takes over the ship, and Picard says that they have a few things to discuss. Dang it, we didn't get to see that conversation. How do you suppose that went?
I don't know. Almost as non-awkward as Barclay watching him kiss his girlfriend.
that was a little bit off-putting.
That was a bit, yeah, that was a bit creepy.
Yeah. That was just weird. Okay, yeah. The pattern enhancers. Oh, what an do they need pattern enhancers? What are, like, Wi-Fi extenders for the transporter or what?
I've always interpreted them as Wi-Fi extenders, yeah. Basically, it's something that locally scans and then provides a boost. That's all.
Yeah, so why would it make any sense that they're going to try and use it on the ship?
I think they had them left over from earlier in the season.
Some spare.
These things cost us $100 a piece. We're going to get every cent worth out of it.
I mean, the batteries haven't gone flat in the light on the top, so why not use them?
I mean, I can understand them being, you know, you take them down to a planet and it's very far away and they provide a, you know, a certain beacon that you can lock onto. But when you're literally in the same building, in the same, very close to where you're trying to beam from, you should have all the sensor coverage you need, right?
Yeah, you would think. It makes no sense. Okay. So Barclay arrives to the holodeck with the enhancers and has a marvelous conversation with the Countess about what they're trying to do.
Hang on. I've just thought of something. Barclay brought the enhancers into the holodeck when there was already inside the program.
Yeah.
Which so Moriarty programmed. Moriarty wouldn't know about the pattern enhancers.
Well, in complete fairness, Moriarty wouldn't know about Dr. Crusher either. But
no, but he could have got that from the ship's personnel files.
Okay, well, could you not have got this from a replicated database somewhere?
Yeah, but he wouldn't know what they do. He needed them to work out what they could. He needed them to work that part out.
Well, I have to say, I do have to say that Moriarty in this episode has to be so far ahead of everyone that, to be honest with you, I don't see any. Why would he? He has to be on such a different level that I don't think he would even want to be a, you know, real boy and leave the holodeck, because he has total power within his domain and he's given it all up, right?
Yeah.
So he's so far ahead of everyone. He's such a he's on a completely different level, and I don't see what he gains when he would leave. He'll be sitting there and in the shuttle with the Countess without a toilet. I mean, and taking 7 million years to get to the nearest planet. I mean, that's no way to live.
There's no toilet.
What?
There's no toilet.
Because you see the entire.
Yeah, but there's cupboards and all that. It could be like one of them camper vans where it's in one of them cupboards.
Well, I mean, I would go as far as saying that that's no way to live either.
No, they beam the poo out.
Yeah, it's like when Picard is on the shuttle with Wesley and the sandwich is there in a cupboard.
Mm-hmm. Picard, you know, spent 30 minutes making those sandwiches.
Yeah, Texas snack.
Mm-hmm. Or did Guinan do it for him?
And it wasn't also when the shuttlecraft that they gave him, it wasn't one of the small ones, it was one of the big ones.
It was one of the bigger ones, but that's like saying your prison cell is one of the bigger ones. It's still a relatively small space to be confined.
Well, a prison cell's got a toilet in it.
Indeed, which is why I still feel that staying on the holodeck is the best place to be.
There's toilets on the holodeck.
Yeah.
Toilet on the holodeck, yeah. Okay, so anyway, yeah, they have a nice little conversation about how she's looking forward to seeing the real world. And even compares it to Africa, where she got to wear trousers the whole time.
Yes, little dig at Victorian England there.
It was hard to go back to a corset. I can imagine it is hard to go back to a corset.
I can't imagine in the slightest, and don't particularly want to.
No. What's a tsetse fly?
Doc.
I don't know. I assume it's some type of thing out in Africa that probably killed people through malaria. But I mean, that's guessing.
Yeah, I couldn't find anything on Google, so it made no sense.
Really? Okay. Usually Google is good at these things.
Mm-hmm. If it's real, I suppose. Okay, so it's now time to...
Tetsy.
I thought she said tsetse fly.
Tsetse fly.
No, I had subtitles on. It's like a really weird one. It's like ST something ST. So it's not. It appeared to have a foreign spelling.
I got it. Tsetse fly are large biting flies that inhabit subtropical Africa. They feed on your blood.
What did I say?
And in the process of feeding on your blood, they transmit various diseases to the host.
Including
sleeping sickness, transposomosis.
Transporter psychosis.
Yeah, transporter psychosis, yeah.
That's funny. Okay.
Yeah. And they can inject things that leave into your bloodstream, proboscis, head delves into the skin. Yeah, they're nasty little suds.
Phew. Is there any good to these things? Anyway, so he brings the enhancers in. He's going to try and beam a chair off of the holodeck because, you know, we wouldn't want to try it on the countenance just yet. It's so thoughtful. Isn't he thoughtful, James?
Yes.
I appreciated that, yeah.
Yes.
So, okay. Oh, let's see here. And of course, it doesn't work, and there are no logs for data to check out.
Did you spot the error?
Hmm?
Did you spot the error?
I didn't. What error?
Right. Data says, show me the log. Right? Yeah. And the number the data says is not the number of the log.
No, it says no data.
Data says the transport log on the screen that data's looking at says transport log 721. The computer says back to data, it's transport log 759.
Ah.
That's probably why they can't find it.
Yeah, and data says that is the correct log, but it's not. It's two different logs. The one on the screen is 721. The one that he's talking about is 759.
You know, and that was another question I wondered. 759. Is that the 759th transport for the entire run of the Enterprise? For the month? For the year?
Probably for the week. I mean, it's the flagship, isn't it? So I should imagine it's pretty busy.
You think there's 759 transports a week? That's a lot of work there.
You've got a crew of... you've got a 1,000-strong crew.
Yeah. So, but I thought O'Brien was pretty bored in the transporter some days.
Yeah, but they're using transporter room 3, remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In this episode, whereas Riker's in, you know, he's probably in transporter room 1.
Yeah.
That's why he's bored, because everything that's going on is going in transporter room 3.
Hmm. Okay.
Because there's like 6 transporters, is there, on the Enterprise? Something like that.
Don't remember.
Yeah, I think there's 6. Because he says in this episode they're in Holodeck 3, didn't they? So.
Mm-hmm. So Picard gives his command codes to the computer. And that was Picard Epsilon 793, if you guys were wondering.
If you ever want to take over the flagship.
Yes, it's easy to be done. Just after that happens, Data arrives just in the nick of time to prevent nothing. The deed is already done. And of course he tosses a device at Geordi, who catches it with his left hand. And Geordi is right-handed. We're not going to go through all that again. So no. In a nutshell, it turns out they never left the holodeck. And,
which is a good reveal.
Mm-hmm.
The reveal is good, that they're in a program, inside the program. It's a good reveal.
Yep. Data, who here is real? just us three, that's it. So Riker, you know, the real one, that is arguing with Moriarty over the view screen. And he senses a lack of enthusiasm on their part, so he presses a few buttons.
Do you think they told Barclay, by the way, that the only three that are real is them?
No, I don't think they did. Hmm. Barclay probably would have said something like, "You're not real. I don't have to listen to you."
Yeah, that's true.
So they have to be able... They have to figure a way out of this, and the way Picard figures was give him everything he wants. So he lays the trap out. Visit the Countess and let her know that they figured out how to do get a real matter off the holodeck. And they have a nice little exchange back and forth with each other. She's a woman not only of breeding, but of wit and sagacity. And yes, I had to look that up as well. Sagacity, the quality of being sagacious.
Hope that helps.
Yeah, it did. It did. So I thought, well, let's take a one more step here.
You're not going to expand on that.
Yeah, I had to expand on that. Having or showing keen mental discernment and good judgment, or being shrewd. That sums her up.
Yeah, sounds like someone who'd be with Moriarty.
Mm-hmm. And Picard is a man of charm and guile. Ah. So anyway, they found out he tells her they have to uncouple the transporters, Heisenberg compensators, and allow them to scramble eggs. Something like that.
Yeah.
And then they can remove stuff off the holodeck. What? Go ahead.
Eggs are not scrambled.
Yes. So it's the mumble jumbo and so on.
This techno babble.
Yes. Oh, and by the way, let's keep it a secret, would you? Don't tell the professor. We don't want to get his hopes up. And of course, she just can't. Oh, I have to tell. Oh, she's such a rat. So Moriarty calls for the Arch. I like that. Arch! And has a little discussion with Riker, where he wants to talk about unscrambling the eggs. They attempt it, and guess what? It works! I knew all along it would. Sort of.
At this part of the episode, I almost thought that Picard was trying to get a message out to Riker.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Because I would have imagined that, you know, being like three deep in a holodeck program, you don't get to the top to create a new holodeck program to wrap around that holodeck program. So I was just wondering, it seemed to be heading that direction, right? But apparently, no, it wasn't that at all. Apparently, Data and Picard and Barclay were able to reprogram the program from within the program that they were put inside of by the program.
Good job.
I don't know how that works.
Oh, I was hoping you were going to explain it, because it seems like Picard started a third program. But when it's all said and done, he ends the program and then ends the program. Only two. I would have thought there would have been a third program. Or then what's in that cube? The program in the program? Or the program in the program in the program?
The program in the cube is the end program when they leave on the shuttlecraft, which is the program that Data stroke Picard created to fool Moriarty.
Right. That's a pretty good one, though.
Yeah. And then a nice touch as well with the name of the shuttlecraft as well.
I didn't see it. What is it?
It's the Sakharov. Sakharov was a human rights activist.
Ah, fascinating. Boy, they worked hard on that one.
Yeah.
All right. So question here. Does this shuttle have warp drive?
No shuttles have warp drive.
No? None?
Do they? Do shuttles have warp? When did the shuttles start getting warp drive?
Because when? No, they have warp drive. When they give, when Picard goes to the starbase with, what's it, Wesley, they have warp drive. Yeah. When they give Scotty a shuttlecraft, they say it's only capable of warp 2.
Yeah.
Shuttlecrafts have warp drive.
I'm happy to be corrected, but I don't. So first of all, the Scotty one you can have, whatever. I don't think I've ever seen stars, spinning across the screen a la warp drive. I don't think I've ever seen that until they get the runabouts. And I'm pretty sure that when they had when they had Picard and Wesley going off to the starbase, they were literally just stood there in empty space. And it appeared, I mean, we mentioned at the time, it appeared that they were going at impulse to get across a star system. And yeah, all of this makes sense. You need warp drive in shuttles, otherwise it makes the... it's almost a punishment to be given us.
According to Memory Alpha, most shuttlecraft are short-range impulse drive ships.
Okay.
However, the larger shuttlecraft did have warp capability.
Some of them
did, basically, but the warp capability was not beyond warp, was never demonstrated to be beyond warp 2.
Now, isn't warp 2 something like, you know, 5 times or 10 times the speed of light? Something like that?
Something like that, yeah. I mean, well, the Enterprise NX-01 was warp 5, weren't it?
And isn't, I think that warp 2 doesn't get you to, look, the state that Scotty was in, warp 2 doesn't get him to the nearest planet before he croaks, right? So,
no, of course not.
Well, they said it would get him to the northern colony.
Well, I mean, his body might have got there.
Yeah, they never said how far the northern colony is. But he does say, was it Riker says to him, head to, I can't remember the planet, but he says head to so-and-so, which is the nearest planet. But they do seem to be going. I can't find anything anywhere that references the fact that a shuttlecraft can go more than warp 2.
How fast could the runabouts go? So I thought that was mentioned.
I'll have a look.
First, like,
but the other thing in all is you never see a shuttlecraft with a warp core.
No, you don't. Because they don't have them. They were never supposed to have them. And then they got into a pickle because they put these people on multi-million light year travel without a warp drive. And it's just
no
work.
Toilet.
And no toilet either. No toilet, no place to stretch your legs. I'm still worried about Tin Man coming out, to be honest.
Mm. So what happens when Moriarty or the Countess would die in their natural progression of life? Or do they ever die? I mean...
Oh, depending on if they programmed it in.
Yeah, I suppose they could have had children, and the children had children, and then just generations of Moriartys running in this cube. Yeah, I got a feeling,
The Delta Flyer is... Voyager shuttlecrafts were reported as going as warp 4. The Delta Flyer could do warp 7, but that was a one-off because that was built with warp technology. The Danube, which was a runabout in DS9, according to the writer specs, at a top speed of warp 5.
Yeah, that actually rings a bell. That warp 5 for the runabouts. Was there any worse idea ever than introducing the Delta Flyer?
No.
I really hate it.
Threshold.
No, that's fine.
No, it's not.
Delta Flyer, crikey almighty, that was a... I'm looking forward to rewatching Voyager at some point to see whether or not my hostility has faded. I feel like I'm becoming more laid back as I get older.
Are we going to be around for that in 14 years? Okay.
God, can you imagine that then? If that shuttlecraft that Wesley and Picard were on when he was going for his Star Trek exam and it didn't have warp drive, that must have been hours in that shuttlecraft alone with him.
Yeah, but literally to go the distance that you could transport someone by.
Yeah, so you would be in a confined space with your boss for hours at a time.
I've mentioned this before, but the idea of ever using a shuttlecraft is the equivalent of, you know, when you're driving along a motorway at 70 miles an hour, for you to stop, for you to get out, and for not to fall. But at this point, you should, like, you know, roll slowly across the road. I mean, it's just... it is literally the idea that you get out of a plane and it's way slower than walking in terms of the ratios involved. And no one would ever do that. You'd never... It's like you'd drop your wife off in town. You'd never, like, drop her off with 6 miles to go and suggests she slowly rolls into town.
It's the way they always do it. Yeah. When episodes begin on the holodeck or on a shuttlecraft, something's going to happen.
Well, always. In fact, because the whole point of it, right, is that it's not, you know, the technology is there. You know, the transporter technology is there in order to save people going up and down. The view screen technology is there in order for you to be able to talk to people without having to meet face to face. The shuttle technology is there merely to isolate a subset of the crew, and the holodeck technology is there in order to take advantage of other films filming on the lot and the things that go wrong. I mean, that's just what the technology is there for.
Well, in TOS, didn't they only use the shuttlecraft when they couldn't use the transporter?
I'm trying to think about when they used the
Because they used it. You see, an ion storm, you can't use the transporter, so they used the shuttlecraft. And at certain atmospheric conditions where you couldn't use a transporter, yet they used the shuttlecraft.
Yeah, I think that's generally when.
In that case, then the short range thing works.
Well, there doesn't matter. Doesn't Spock steal a shuttle and heads off to Talos IV in the menagerie, which kind of suggests they've been doing this since the very, 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 very beginning.
All right, guys, let's see here. So Picard fools Moriarty into giving command over. He had to give up his Moriarty Alpha 24159. It unlocks the ship, and they get the hell out of the way of these two planets are going to bang into each other and create a new star. And they do. And a new baby girl star is born. All's well that ends well. So here's another thing. Do you think as intelligent as Moriarty is, do you think he'll ever figure out that he's actually stealing a holodeck program of sorts? And how much could that cube actually contain of real planets or the real universe?
Well, it wasn't the cube, was it? It was the thing you put the cube in, because that's what Barclay says. This device will have enough data in to keep them happy.
Well, he said enough memory, but it doesn't really specify. I mean, is it the real universe?
I thought he said at the end when he puts it into that thing, he said this will have enough. So they'll never know, basically.
Yeah, you wouldn't think so. Yeah. So he, you know, Moriarty eventually does get what he wants. I wonder how many crimes he commits in that cube.
A lot.
They went on multi-planet crimes sprees. So. Okay.
Rango.
Yeah. Or the pack lids. Sounds.
Yeah. Probably dominate the pack lids, he would.
Mm. So I guess the cube runs forever. Okay, so Barclay makes sure everything is real around him by asking the computer to end program. And of course, nothing happens. So he's good. Is this the last time we see Barclay until the movie?
No, we haven't in Masks. Not Masks. Genesis.
That's right.
The other fantastic one.
He turns into a spider, doesn't he?
He's always been part spider.
Yeah.
It's just that this part gets encouraged
That episode, he de-evolved. They're supposed to be de-evolving. So they're saying that at some point in human history, we were spiders.
Yeah. It depends on what his parents were. Maybe one was a spider.
I've always read it as that we share a certain amount of genetic code in common with spiders.
In that case, then he could have de-evolved into a banana.
Yeah, indeed, and I don't know, I assume there was like all of the ensigns on deck 4, which is bananas.
Yeah, bananas. They're all bananas. All right.
And then Worf obviously popped in and had lunch.
And I thought this was going to be a quick show. Excuse me.
Well, don't know. You can go to bed in a bit.
I know. I'm fine. Hey, you guys have had to put up with being up till midnight or later for me. So this is, you know, I owe you guys a lot. So anyway, but we have come to the end. Did I miss anything or did I miss a lot?
No, I think we covered everything.
The only thing I'd say, though, is
that... I thought I'd be talking about bananas in Star Trek, though, but there you go.
The only thing I'd say is that this idea of which kind of Barclay floats with, right, which is the, you know, is he living in the simulator? And to what extent, how would he be able to know whether it's a simulator or not? And it doesn't come down to be able to shout out computer and program. But I actually think that since the episode aired, I think that there's probably been more in popular culture that might be a possibility, or that theoretically could be a possibility. And I think there's more zeitgeist now for the idea of living in a computer simulation than there was in the early 90s. So it just shows you that Trek was ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm. Was this episode before or after The Matrix?
Oh, before. Before. Matrix was like 1999, wasn't it?
Was it?
Yeah, it was.
I don't know.
I think it was at the turn of the millennium. Because I saw it with the wife, and I was not with the wife. Yep, Matrix 99.
Right, so it's 6 years before then.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And with a lot of stuff about, like, you know, a lot of this, like, ancestor simulator has become popular, or at least there is a bit of a thing about it recently with developments in AI and the like, and, you know, there are these theories going around, or brain teaser is not the right word, but kind of thought experiments, maybe, is that, you know, if you accept that at a certain point in humanity that we are going to put together, you know, ancestor simulators, so things on which we basically have artificial intelligence running within a computer program, if you accept that that's a possibility, then the number of people that are going to be inside of these simulations, not aware that they're inside these simulations, are going to vastly outnumber the number of people in the quote-unquote real world. And then, so if you take the proposition that we're going to do this, it almost confines anyone with consciousness or with anyone that believes themselves to be real. The vast majority of those people are going to be inside these computer simulations. And I think that kind of idea has had a bit of a renaissance over the last 4 or 5 years. But it's good to see it kind of like cropping up in Star Trek. In the early 90s. Well, actually, maybe the issue here is that the guys that are putting this stuff out there used to watch TNG when they were kids. Maybe that's where it's all come from.
Well, yeah. I mean, because look how many people are doing what they're doing now in the professions because of their inspiration from Star Trek.
Yeah, it's exactly that, right?
Yeah.
I shouldn't be surprised that, yeah, it's not that TNG is ahead of the curve, it's that all these Trekkies now have influence.
Yeah, they've watched an episode and made it reality. I mean, the mobile phone, the guy watched the original season, the original series, seen the flip communicator, and thought, I wonder if I can make that work. And he invented the mobile phone.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's pretty cool, yeah.
iPads. Tablets, Star Trek. You know, tricorders that are now being worked on, Star Trek. You know, AI. Star Trek was way ahead of all that.
Maybe.
Well, not AI. AI has been in science fiction for decades, but, you know.
Well, Star Trek's 50 odd years old.
Yeah, but I mean, you can see things from the 40s and the 50s when they're implying AI, you know. Although maybe. I still think Amazon missed a trick by not having Michelle Roddenberry as the voice of Alexa.
Look, I still don't understand why we have Siri and we have Alexa and we have all of these things that you're supposed to say, hey, Google. I mean, why can't I say computer? I mean, surely you should be able to say computer and get a response from a computer.
That would be cool.
It's like thousands of times better, right?
Wonder how many devices we've set off now by saying, hey, Google, and hey, Alexa.
But no one I can ask, no one really has this stuff, right? Do they?
Yeah, I've got Alexa.
But do people, you always hear that people will complain that, oh, someone's going to mention Xbox off, and then apparently the world blows up. It doesn't really happen, does it?
No, I don't know. I haven't got an Xbox. But I have got an Alexa.
Really?
Does it work?
Yeah.
That's fine on you.
So what does it do?
What will I use it for? I tell it to turn the radio on. I tell it to turn the lights on, the heating. If you've got smart plugs and smart lights, you can turn them on and off for you. So, you know, if you somewhat you want off Amazon, you can just tell it to order it for you. Lots of things.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I wanted to come up with a Facebook post, a video. My daughter's name is Alexa. I mean, obviously, she's 17, way before the Alexa came out. But I want to do, like, a video of me saying, hey, guys, this is my comments on Alexa. You guys think Alexa's so great. I don't think it's so good. And then I would say something like, you know, Aaron, I'll show you what I mean. Alexa, turn the thermostat down to 74 degrees. Then I would turn the phone to her and she'd say, no. Alexa, turn the TV on to whatever channel. Turn it to her and she says, no. Alexa, put on iHeartRadio. Leave me alone. Right? I think it'd be funny. And then I'd say, like, well, yeah, see, Alexa's not so great after all.
So the first thing is, as soon as I have a computer assistant, what I need is a computer assistant with attitude. A bit like, you know, coffee. Get it yourself.
Get it yourself. Yeah, well, that did happen, didn't it? Get it yourself. All right. Anyway, I think it's time to give our final thoughts and ratings on this episode on a scale of 1 to 5. 1 being the worst, 5 being... I don't think so. The best. Colin, you started our show. You start the final thoughts.
I like this episode. There's fun parts to it. It's clever. There's lots of layers. I like the way they use Barclay to explain what's going on, which is basically Barclay's function. He's very much a side character, but they use him really well. I like the... It's basically like a Chinese puzzle box, and it's a box inside a box, and then you get the different levels, and the humour is brilliant in it. You know, like we've said about Geordi, fake Geordi being upset when he finds out he's a fake Geordi, and the casting is brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And like James says, you know, they do English accents quite well. The fact it still tickles me that he thinks the bloke in Enterprise does the worst thing in Jackson's, even though he's English. But yeah, there's lots of layers, lots of depth to it. There's nice little twists. The reveals were well done. The acting's brilliant. And it's a nice wrap-up at the end. Although, obviously, now they're sitting on a planet somewhere because the Enterprise crashed. But hey, you know, they tried. I'd give it 4. It's a solid 4.
Okay, so then, pretty brief here. I do like this as well. I like the mystery within the mystery, like you said. And who doesn't love a good mystery? I guess I'm curious about how this hollow cube can allow them to live out a life. Is there any predetermined encounters, or does it... How does a holographic character change its mind or change its course, and this cube responds based on his input? It'd be interesting to know a little bit more about it. But I still think a man as gifted as Moriarty could probably someday figure out that he's still in a program, and then he'd be even more pissed. But there's nothing he could do because he has no way out of the bottle this time. He had his 3 wishes, I guess. So Genie's stuck in the bottle. Anyway, our last Sherlock mystery with the professor. It's not the best. It isn't the best, but I do like it. And I agree. 4 is probably good for me too. So, Professor James, What do you think?
Not a professor, I'm afraid.
Maybe in 30 years.
Actually, I've considered going back into academia, but I've been banned. Anyway, that's a longer... When I say I've been banned, I've not been banned from work with children or anything. I've been banned from my wife.
Yeah.
She thinks I shouldn't do it. And okay. I respect my wife's opinion. Just so there are no rumors that get started off the back of that slip of the tongue. I'm happy to go with a 4 on this episode as well. It's a fun caper of an episode. It's good that we revisit. Just looking ahead of some of the episodes that are coming up, I know that we revisit a couple of stories that were planted, many moons ago in Trek, and we actually don't. We get an episode that comes up really at the end of season seven, that has an even longer gap between the first and the second parts. But I think this episode does the first episode proud, and I think that the performances are good. I think that the story is a lot of fun. Yeah, I don't like when they try to explain what the holodeck and the transporter are, and there are a couple of holes you can poke here. But I think overall, kind of like a nice, fun episode. So happy to agree with you guys and give it a 4 all round.
Right, great minds think alike.
Before you sign off, Lou, I just looked up the transcript. And it says, Barclay says at the end that the portable device has enough active memory to provide them with experiences for a lifetime.
Hmm.
Yeah, but whose lifetime? And were they very boring?
That's the thing. This is going back to what we said earlier. It's enough for what lifetime? Because they're not actually alive, so are they going to die?
What if it ended in a murder-suicide? Does Cube just shut off?
Don't say that.
Well, it probably shut off when Deanna crashed the ship.
Well, it got bounced around, but I don't know if it would have shut off.
Well, if the cube come out of the box, that's it. Game over.
Well, I don't know. Barclay was supposed to keep control of it, so maybe he was very...
Sam, he's an apartment back on Earth on a shelf.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He probably played with that cube every night in bed.
Anyway...
All right, thank you for coming on again. And so, everyone, join us next time as we review episode 13 for season 6, and that's Aquil.
That's all the respect it needs.
Oh, good lord. Is that the one where Geordi's creeping this girl's personal logs?
Creepy Geordi.
Yeah, jeez. I mean, okay, so I get it. Picard says, listen and see if there's any hints and clues as to what happened. Well, once she gets into, hello, Emily. How are you today? I'm fine. Fast forward. You don't need to listen to all of this. But my memory of it is a little fuzzy, so we need to go. All right. Good night.
Good night. Or good morning. Whatever.
Good night, everyone.
Night.